are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
From Nice Guy Productions headquarters overlooking the glamorous San Fernando Valley, I'm Mick Garris, and this is Postmortem. What did you do during the pandemic? Yes, I know it's not over yet, and as a matter of fact, just as I'm recording this, Los Angeles has just reinstituted the mask mandate. But life is slowly getting back to an altered new normal. People are going back to work, getting on planes, traveling, going to restaurants and movies. It's been bad. I've had a couple of friends hit hard by the virus, even spending a couple of months on a ventilator in the hospital. Film and television production has resumed, though not at 100%. Friends have been shooting in Canada, where there's been a two-week hotel quarantine for traveling cast and crew before they can report to work. Production protocols have tightened, and filmmaking has hopefully gotten safer. But at least for a year or so, work and play have been at a standstill. How have you been handling it? For me, it's been a time of writing rather than directing, writing stories and screenplays, creating series Bibles, hiking, reading, watching movies at home, eating lots of takeout. The international film festivals that occupied so much of my travel time are all in the rearview mirror, though I have glimpses of a couple of future ones in my sights. What about you? How has life in the time of pandemic changed for you? Has working by Zoom completely changed your occupation? Do you interface remotely or in person with coworkers? Have you used the time to seek out new directions of creativity and discovery? Have you started learning a new language or taking art classes? Our guest today, Neil Blomkamp, the mastermind behind such visual feasts as District 9, Elysium, and Chappie, really made the most of his social distancing. Using a tiny cast and crew, he made a movie on a much smaller and more intimate scale than we're used to from him, creating something during the coronavirus under safe and intimate conditions. We'll talk about his work on movies big and small after this. Available now from Dread, Howling Village. From the visionary director of The Grudge and The Grudge 2 comes Howling Village, where, after her brother goes missing, a young psychologist visits an infamous haunted and cursed location known as, what else, Howling Village, to investigate his disappearance and uncover her family's dark history. Howling Village will be available on demand everywhere and on Blu-ray September 14th. Also coming soon to Dread, Bad Candy. On Halloween night in New Salem, radio DJs Chili Billy, Corey Taylor, and Paul, Zach Galligan, tell a twisted anthology of terrifying local myths that lead to a grim end for small-town residents. So if you love Slipknot, Gremlins, and horror, this is the film for you. Bad Candy is coming out in theaters and on demand September 14th and on Blu-ray October 10th. Before we get started, I'd like to let you know about a new book that has been published. It is actually Abby Bernstein's biography of yours truly. ATB Publishing has decided that such a volume was worth publishing, and I'll never understand why. But it's called Master of Horror, the official biography of yours truly, Mick Garris. And it is available at atbpublishing.com. You can get signed copies at Dark Delicacies at darkdel.com and all around the place. So I'm humbled by this and delighted at the same time. And I hope if you check it out that you'll enjoy it. Thanks. So Neil, great to have you on the slab. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I like the idea of being on the slab. It's awesome.
Yeah. Well, you're one of us, gobble gobble, right?
Yeah.
So you live in Canada, but you were born in South Africa in Johannesburg, and went to high school there. And your interest in film started early on. What was the film industry in South Africa like when you were a teenager and just really starting to get your bones in what movie making was all about?
Well, I mean, it's a really interesting question because when I lived in South Africa, you know, I moved at the end of high school. I was basically 18 by the time I got to Canada. So my sort of teenage years was spent in Johannesburg. And it was only when I landed in Canada that I think I very quickly realized that I could actually work in the film industry. I'm not completely sure that it had occurred to me in South Africa that I would actually be able to work in film. So, you know, pre-1997, because I moved in 97, I have no idea what the South African film industry was in fact like, because and even if I did know what it was like, it probably didn't interest me. You know, everything that I loved was predominantly American or European. So the irony is that over 10 years of being out of South Africa, it was, you know, District 9 in South African culture that kind of drew me back to wanting, I guess, to create films that were about where I had come from. So there was sort of a full loop in there. But, you know, I think if I'd grown up in Southern California, or I'd grown up in Vancouver, I would probably be a filmmaker that would be interested in all of the same topics, less the South African, the history of Africa and the history of Southern Africa. So, you know, I guess that's really what happened, was I had subconsciously just ingested everything that was around me. And by the time I was old enough to make a film about something, it started looking like my interest in the place I had come from had sort of taken over.
Well, a lot of your film work, if not most of your film work, seems to both have a sociological and a technological bent, where they crash up against each other. And it isn't often that a filmmaker has a recurring theme along sociological lines like that. Do you attribute that maybe to your South African background?
Yeah, I mean, almost certainly. It's not easy to grow up in that country and not be aware of class warfare and segregation. It's just woven into the fabric of how the country works. So there's no question that it had an indelible, you know, effect on me that is not going anywhere anytime soon. And I think as I get older now, I've said a lot of what I wanted to kind of express about that topic. I think that I see myself going down other avenues now, like that has less to do with those topics.
Well, once you moved to Vancouver at 18, mm-hmm. you almost immediately went into film school, right? You went to the Vancouver Film School, which is a really good, practical, prestigious film school in Vancouver. And what led to that?
I almost got expelled from Vancouver Film School, actually, to be honest.
Well, there you go.
For multiple different reasons. But the one reason that is probably the most pressing was that I set off the fire alarm. And I'm still not entirely sure why. Like I just sort of pulled the lever on the wall and then the school was evacuated. I don't really know why I did that.
Because the lever was there to pull.
Yeah. No, they showed me like black and white footage of me pulling it, which I guess, it was strange. So yeah, I have a complex history with Vancouver Film School. But I think what happened was when I was in South Africa, I started gravitating towards, you know, again, not thinking I could ever work in the film industry, but having an immense interest in film in general, and specifically model making and prosthetic effects. And then as computer graphics began to take off, I started to skew more towards computer graphics, just again without any defined goal. It was just a case of being creative. And back then in the 90s, Silicon Graphics out of California was the predominant computer company that, you know, you needed that level of hardware to be able to run programs like Alias or Wavefront. And I talked myself into SGI Southern Africa and somehow got on their computers. You know, I don't know. I'm still not sure how I did that. and I kind of started messing around with Alias and like early particle systems and things that were just the beginning of, well, not the beginning, because back then it was like Jurassic Park had come out and Terminator 2 and The Abyss had come out. But I could, you know, I was just completely drawn to film in every single different way. And also sculpting and, you know, prosthetic effects was the other thing. And so when I got to Canada, it was still a case of like, well, I wonder eventually what my job will be. And I almost moved back to South Africa just because I missed Johannesburg. And somehow, you know, got into Vancouver Film School. And then just very quickly, I realized that people were in fact making an income working in visual effects and animation. And so that's kind of how it started for me.
So it's a very rare route to becoming a director, going through the technical end, especially as a CG animator or doing prosthetic effects and the like. But you quickly found success doing computer animation for commercials and various other things that led you into the director's chair. Tell me a little bit about the work. I know Stargate was based in Vancouver, and you worked on shows like that, and Jim Cameron's series.
Battle Angel. Dark Angel. He has two Angel films.
Yeah.
Two Angel IPs. Yeah, I what happened was there was a person who's remained a close friend of mine for all these years, was one of my teachers at VFS, Trevor Kaywood. And you know, again, going back to like me on the verge of being expelled the whole time, he was teaching one of the classes that I was just kind of a bit AWOL in. He was working in the film industry in visual effects. And he was like, look, I can definitely get you a job in this if you want to aim yourself at, you know, a visual effects career. And I met the company that he worked for, which I ended up working for, which at the time was called Rainmaker Visual Effects in Vancouver. And
I remember them, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, I made a bunch of other friends that we actually formed another company called the Embassy Visual Effects out of a group of us that left that company a few years after I joined. But in that period was a massive U-turn in my life, just creatively and in terms of it was a sort of blue sky, open world of opportunity, as far as I could tell, because I looked at filmmakers like Ridley Scott and Fincher, and they had come out of commercials and music videos, and I loved commercials and music videos. You know, some of my favorite forms of expression back then were these more bite-sized chunks of creativity. Chris Cunningham's Aphex Twin music videos and Otakra, you know, all of that stuff was incredible. Right. So I was like, okay, well, I guess if these guys did commercials, I should probably do commercials and then move into film. So directing film was always the goal. It was never anything other than directing film, but there were sort of stepping stones along the way. So one of the things I remember really clearly was we worked on a whole bunch of TV movies and we did visual effects on them. And there was one that we did called, it was called Aftershock, Earthquake in New York.
I was offered that movie.
Really? No, no kidding. That would have been amazing if you had directed that.
Well,
and I was, you know, I was modeling just like shit tons of broken New York skyscrapers. Like we had taken skyscrapers and then, you know, I would tear the front of them off and we'd build the scaffolding and floor structure and then fracture them as though a high Richter scale earthquake had torn up New York. And the production was shooting plate photography in Vancouver, you know, where they'd set up 35 mil cameras and they were moving them against building facades where they'd built the bottom floor of the building. And then above it, we would be doing the extension. And it was the first time I was really on set, and the VFX supervisor let me basically direct or control the way that we were using the camera on set, which was on a Fisher dolly and, you know, had a proper focus puller and everything else attached to it. And I couldn't believe that, you know, everything that I'd sort of learned in computer graphics of moving cameras and lighting and everything else just applied straight over to the real world. But I hadn't really done it in that way. I'd done it with, back then it was Hi8 video cameras that I just had like lying all over my place, and I just would shoot everything on Hi8. But as soon as it was 35 mil, it kind of became more real. And also the weight and scale of the dolly and like how the camera moved was just different. And I just knew there was no question that all I wanted to do was be on set and be doing that. And that turned into, it turned into music videos where, you know, you could just shoot a ton and kind of get familiar with everything, you know. Like I remember when I was about 19, I think I was 19, I directed my first video, which had a decent budget. And I remember the focus puller telling me that it was in fact tilt up and not pan up, because I kept saying pan up. Yes. And And back then with computer graphics, it was like, you were just talking about degrees of rotation, right? In X or Y. So right. it wasn't really a case of there were no technical on set terms, and I didn't really give a shit what they were.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, I'm still like that. I don't give two shits about process. Like, I only care about the result, but it was kind of awesome, going through, you know, this transitionary period. And then I kept scaling my visual effects hours down until eventually the company was like, no, you cannot work one day a week. And I was like, okay, well, I guess I'm directing music videos full time. And then the jump to commercials is another thing. But I started really using visual effects in stuff that I was shooting. And I was obsessed with sort of science fiction hyperrealism. So, and I kept going back to South Africa all the time. And my sort of interest in the place I'd come from was growing. And then I was also seeing family and I was also seeing friends. And I shot this piece where I dropped a computer-generated robot into it. And this was at the point where handheld footage and the use of visual effects in handheld footage was unusual. Yeah. So that piece kind of took off. And I sent it to a much bigger commercial production company than I had ever worked for before in Toronto called Spy Films. And they signed me. And so then I could sort of scale up the commercial sizes I was doing. And from there, I got signed with Ridley Scott's company, with RSA in Los Angeles. And through RSA, I got an amazing agent at WME, Ari Emanuel, who got me onto Halo with Peter Jackson. So it was a sort of a succession of just, you know.
Well, yeah. It goes back to the work with that Fisher Dolly. And I imagine you went through motion control headaches and the like. But it's become sort of... A signature of yours, a lot of handheld use with CG, which is much more difficult to do than with, you know, static shots or a dolly, because of all your focal points and the constant moving of that. But it seems to have become a signature. Is that because of the freedom it gave you to really do anything you want in the frame?
I think, I mean, you know, a lot of the time with any artistic endeavor in general, I'm always very weary of artists who can over intellectualize stuff. And I prefer art and I prefer stuff that comes from me to be much more intuitive and sort of somewhat unexplainable. But I think the answer to that question is I'm very interested in trying to present the most convincing and hyper-real version of something fantastical. The more fantastical it is presented more mundanely, the more of a kick I get out of it, you know, both as a creator and also as a viewer. So that's probably the reason. But the motion control headaches are, I mean, I want nothing to do with that. You know, I that was back when I was doing VFX. It was, I mean, you referenced James Cameron's Dark Angel. And if you look at I only worked on the first season and I'm not really sure where it went. But if you look at the opening shot of Jessica Alba on the Space Needle in Seattle, the same friend that I was saying pretty much hired me, who was teaching me at VFX, the same friend and I did that shot of her on the Space Needle. And that was all motion control because we had to line it up with Jessica Alba, shoot her, and then, you know, use our motion control to place her into our 3D environment. So the sort of the data of our CG camera lined up with the data of the on-set stuff. Of course, now today you would just shoot her however you want and drop her in and track it.
Right.
And then we went to Seattle and we needed to get a ton of texture photos of the Space Needle. And he actually went out on safety equipment and kind of walked the perimeter of it with the VFX supervisor. And I couldn't stomach doing that just because I have a fear of heights. So that didn't work out. But yeah, motion control, I want nothing to do with. Anything that just kind of gets in the way of the production like that is not cool.
Well, I had to deal with those headaches on Sleepwalkers and again on Riding the Bullet and a couple other things. And
yeah.
It is such a pain in the ass. Yeah. But, you know, the Stargate stages you used were the stages we shot Masters of Horror on for two seasons.
When did you shoot that?
That was 2015 through 2005 through 2007.
Okay.
And it was right after Dark Angel as well, because Toby Hooper shot part of his episode on that dystopian village, the city set there.
But you're talking about Terminal City.
Terminal City is where Toby shot his episode.
So you know what's really insane? This is totally crazy. I shot a whole bunch of music videos there. I mean, besides the film and TV visual effects that I was doing, I shot and directed a whole bunch of my own stuff and music videos at Terminal City. And then fast forward to 2015, when my brother and I started Oat Studios, which is this insane, you know, experimental studio. We just sold it a couple of days ago, but we actually bought an office that was in the corner of where Terminal City would have been, where I did hair and makeup, like, you know, for that, that's kind of where we would always base hair and makeup. And that whole place was destroyed, and this new modern structure was put up with a whole bunch of units. And we had one that was our Oats studio for like a year or two. I mean, that was a really strange circle, you know? So if you go there now, it just looks like a sort of Santa Monica style modern tech building.
Well, tell me a little about Oats Studios. You mentioned it's an experimental production house. Is that where you kind of grow crops of ideas to turn into features? It's kind of a brewery for your imagination?
No, not really. It's definitely a place of just like an imaginative, you know, sandbox to go and play. But they're not meant to be turned into features. I've always thought of Oats as being explicitly never touching Hollywood. So the goal was to try to sell more shorts or films online, digitally, to the audience in a way that would never touch any streaming or Hollywood studio. But for now you can think of it like just a creative, you know, playpen of stuff.
Right, where it's unmitigated by commercial forces.
Yeah, like hence Cooking with Bill.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned Peter Jackson and Halo, and that did not happen. Tell me about how that process kept going, because it was percolating for a long time before it finally nosedove.
Yeah, I mean, it was also percolating with Guillermo del Toro, who had gone down to New Zealand and spent, you know, a bunch of time and a bunch of money getting ready to direct that movie. I'm not actually sure why Guillermo didn't stay on it. I don't really know what the reason is for that. But when I came on board, I mean, that was another sort of marker in my life where, you know, just seeing what Peter had built and Weta Workshop and Weta Digital and the kind of this very creative ecosystem that existed in Wellington, it was a real awesome, eye-opening, amazing time for me. But I sort of inherited the project from Guillermo, and I spent a long time, you know, going through design. We knew there were certain staple elements that would stay in the film, but we hadn't really locked in on a story and a script yet. And it was in the process of hiring writers and beginning to actually get that nailed down where the whole production just sort of spiraled out of control. And I think it was a combination of multiple factors, but when you have Microsoft taking a bunch of the profits, and then you also have a co-production between Fox and Universal, there was, you know, it was just split too many ways in terms of control and in terms of profits, and it just fractured, really.
So that would have been your first feature film.
Yeah.
But in a way, it was kind of fortuitous, because you and Peter decided to join forces on District 9, which was your first feature film.
Yeah.
You wrote it with your wife, Terry Tetchell, and were nominated for an Oscar for the screenplay. But you went from being an effects tech to a guy who directed commercials and music videos. And now your first feature film, you made it in South Africa, but it's acquired by a major studio. It's supported by a major studio. And you had a big Hollywood hit on your hands.
I mean, it was massively, you know, it was luck, I think, hugely, to be given the opportunity by Peter and by Fran. You know, Fran, I think whether it was Pete or it was Fran, both of them kind of, the day Halo collapsed, they came back and said, what else do you want to make? And I'd shot a short film called Alive in Joburg, which was beginning to express these ideas of xenophobia in South Africa through science fiction. And I showed it to them and they both said, okay, like let's turn that into a film. And I mean, it's, you know, blind luck that you can get people like that behind you, supporting you, and then start working to turn it into a viable story. I think the time that it really clicked for me was, you know, it, because ultimately everything just comes down to character and story. I mean, there really isn't anything else. And it was the Sholto who acted in it. I knew that he was incredibly good at improvising and just sort of messing around. You know, he would do that with the people that worked for him, and just in social situations, he was just kind of very good at impersonating people. And I think when it clicked for me was a combination of getting Sholto to do a test. Like I went and shot a test with him to show to Peter and Fran of what this Afrikaans character would be like in a science fiction setting. And when you combine that level of improvisation with this idea of the oppressor becoming the oppressed, which actually is kind of like The Fly, since you're connected to The Fly too. It's very The Fly, right? It's very Kafkaesque and transformative. And so we were using a sort of science fiction and metaphorical parable of transformation that instantly clicked for me. It kind of clicked for everyone, where it was like, I understand what the character's going through. And the moment that happened, the film really fell into place, you know, quite easily in terms of story. But it was difficult to shoot. It was very difficult to make that film.
Well, it seems to be. Not only is it a scale much larger than I'm sure is belied by the budget, but just the political situation and the vastness of it. Tell me the complications of that shoot and what made it such a heavy burden.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, there were multiple different things. The one thing that was definitely amazing was Peter shielded me entirely from the studio. I mean, if I got any notes, they were from Pete. And
nice.
Which is incredible. And, you know, the chance of that film happening, if you think about it, is just absolutely insane. Like, first time director, first time actor, set in South Africa with a budget of $30 million. About aliens, you know, the ties to xenophobia. I mean, it's like the chance of that getting made is incredibly slim. But I think probably the biggest thing was when you're shooting in a totally improvised style like that, and you have handheld cameras, and the area that we were shooting in was an area of Soweto, you know, which was difficult to get in and out of and heavily polluted. And we had security concerns, and we sort of had to travel in as a convoy and travel out as a convoy. When you mix that also with it being your first film, it was just a very tumultuous time, you know, but I also could tell that it was a time that I would never forget, which was true.
So tell me about the writing process, how you and your wife worked on this and how long it took. And you'd already made a short film with the same basic thesis.
Yeah.
But tell me how you made it bloom together.
Well, I mean, it really just comes down to the idea of once what I was saying about this idea of a character that transforms and becomes oppressed and wears the other shoe, you know, it. Once you have that, then the framework for the story just becomes right. We did have a screenplay, but we also had almost like a document. The way that I would do it with Sholto was, and I kind of want to do this going forward with other improvised movies, is you discuss what the meaning of the scene is, and then you shoot based on getting that meaning across. And often the first few improvised sessions are too long. And you kind of pick the areas that you really like, and then you throw out the stuff that doesn't work. And so by take three or four, you're in a zone where it feels insanely natural and realistic because of how you got there, but it's also conveying what it needs to convey on a story level. And so in order to get there, Terry and I wrote a document and a screenplay that would sort of, you know, would get us there. And in the process of getting to those documents, you really just go through more of a standard procedure of what do the characters want? You know, what are they looking for? Do you have turning points that feel natural and sort of derived by character, but also are satiating what the audience is looking for, you know, the middle of the second act or your turn into the third act? And yeah, I mean, it's a standard process, I guess.
So, well, not so standard if you're doing so much improvisation, but especially when you've got a group of actors that are all interacting with one another and still trying to achieve that same goal. Yeah. How long do you spend in the morning with your rehearsals before you start to hone in on what the scene is?
I don't think we ever rehearsed anything. And I mean, I still don't really rehearse stuff. Like, I just don't really, like, I'm such a massive believer in just trying to capture. It's like this authenticity that comes when you just do it the first time. And I like being surprised by stuff and sort of working with it. And I think if you over rehearse things, you can bring a staleness to it. I mean, I'm just speaking for me. I'm not speaking for like other directors, obviously, because everyone has a radically different style. But I definitely tend to want to capture something that feels the most raw and surprising. And I kind of go after that. The difference with District 9, though, was because it was completely improv, and some of the actors were okay with it and others were less okay, it created a very volatile environment. But I mean, obviously we did cost going in knowing that we would be doing improv. So all of the casting sessions were based on improvised, you know, moments where people would just would operate with no script. I mean, I would describe making that film as somewhat chaotic.
Well, it shows in a positive sense, because yeah, what's going on in front of the cameras is chaotic as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it has an energy and a dynamism about it, I think, that comes from that.
Well, tell me about telling the first full-length story on film that you did, because you'd done lots of short things where you have images, you have feelings, you have moments, but here's one that you're going from point A to point Z, mm-hmm, and you have to do all the roller coasters and valleys and hills and make it a two-hour movie. Tell me about that experience for the first time for you.
I mean, you know, I think features really kind of make sense to me. I think television makes less sense to me in the sense that it's much, I feel like there's a sort of DNA in the mythology of how a three-act structure story works that really clicks with me. So I didn't have any sort of daunting problem about doing a feature film or maintaining holding onto the story in my head in a way that I was scaling up to the size of a two-hour movie, and everything else I had done had been shorts. It was more, the thing that was more, that I was more aware of and was more daunting was, you know, like in Alien at the beginning, when Ridley shows you the ship and he shows you all of the elements and the crew is in cryostasis and he has that little bird that is on, it's sort of almost like a metronome. It's on its little weighted, you know, gyro that it's moving, mm-hmm, back and forward with. It's these sorts of interstitial shots that District 9 is a different kind of movie. It doesn't use things the same way, but it was the idea of what are the shots that are required in order that when you're sitting in the edit bay, you have enough firepower in the footage that you've shot that you can compose the scenes to flow between one another in a way that will feel cinematic and create what I'm looking for, because I hadn't done it on that scale before. And I remember really thinking hard about that I needed to get that right, you know. And it that felt quite daunting, that it's like you could potentially end up with something that just didn't gel together cinematically the way that I wanted it to. So that brought, I think, more conscious thought than worrying about where I was in terms of a two-hour story.
And how many days did you shoot?
I think all in all, it was 70 days, but I think we shot about 50 and then we sort of regrouped and shot 20.
So you did some reshoots too.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah. Well, you mentioned Alien, and I've never really heard you talk about this before, but you were attached to do an Alien sequel, and it got pretty far down the line. Tell me about that experience, where it was going, and why it didn't.
I mean, you know, the thing that's interesting is moving forward now, because I haven't directed anything that's a feature for 5 years, whether it's been out for 5 or 6 years. And I've had a lot of time to just sort of sit and think and mess around with oats and get my thoughts straight. And there's kind of like, there's a negativity that I find with Alien and with Chappie that sort of, I just feel like I have spoken about it before and I'd rather just leave it because there's nothing really else left to say about it, if that makes sense. And it's one of those things where the IP is so beloved and it's so large that it never goes away. It just follows me around. And it's like, I want to sort of close that chapter and just work on new stuff.
I understand. Does the same go with RoboCop?
RoboCop, RoboCop was a case of, I just wanted to direct something that had more of a horror slant to it before I went and did something that was so sort of robotically science fiction oriented again. What I was going to do was I was going to do a sequel to Verhoeven's RoboCop that started the next day. And also it's the only film I've ever been, you know, connected to where I was trying to emulate a different filmmaker's style. Like I would have done everything I could have to make it feel like Verhoeven had directed it. And which includes this crazy retro future approach where you would have to get the production designer you'd have to lock the production designer into 1987, and then not let him use anything beyond 1987, but try to imagine a future, right? Like, which is a very cool design challenge. So the only thing that I would have used that would have been modern would be, instead of stop motion with Ed 209, like the first one, I would have done computer graphics to just smooth that off. But everything else would have felt like Verhoeven. But MGM wanted to, you know, they just wanted to move quickly and shoot it. And I wanted to do something that was slightly more horror based, or you know, just a different genre slightly, and then come to it. So they just moved on essentially because I didn't feel like doing it right away.
Well, tell me your
experience. It's not that negative, I guess.
Oh, good. Yeah. Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Tell me your experience of seeing your first feature film with your first audience, seeing District 9 play with an audience for the first time, because everything you'd done before that was either on the small screen or it was somebody else's movie or whatever. This, you wrote and directed, it's your baby, and now here it is going out to the public for the first
time. Well, I mean, it's funny because I can't imagine a more perfect way to have done that than the way that it played out, which was Sony flew Peter and I to Comic-Con in 2009, and we played it for a Comic-Con audience in its entirety. And when I was saying that Peter had shielded us from any studio notes, I mean that to the point where we didn't really even do friends and family screenings. Like we did nothing. Like we edited it at his post-production facility. And you know, I even had concerns, and so did Charlton, that the audience wouldn't even understand the somewhat Afrikaans accents in the movie. That's how untested it was. So we did a presentation, and then we played it for an audience in the evening, and got an awesome response. So it's hard to imagine doing that in any way that would have been better than that, you know, which was really cool.
Well, Comic-Con is a great place because there are thousands of people in the theater and they want what you're giving them. They're the most receptive and appreciative audience. If you give them what they want, they will love you back.
Unless you don't give them what they want.
Well, then that's another story entirely. So the success of that leads you to Elysium. You're doing a movie star movie now for the first time, and tell me how that is a change in course for you.
I mean, you know, the thing that is interesting about Elysium and really about filmmaking in general is, as long as you people talk about the scale of films, you know, Elysium, the amount Sony paid for it, I think they paid somewhere around 100 million or 115 million or somewhere in there, and when you talk about films, you know, going from short films to District 9 being about $30 million and then $100 million film, if you set it up correctly, it should feel somewhat intimate and it should feel like the film hasn't run away from you. Interestingly, Halo would probably have felt like it had run away from me, right? That would have been a case of, you know, I could see that becoming a very, very political environment for a host of different reasons. So if you go in with your own idea and your own script and the studio is backing you, the filmmaking process can still feel relatively intimate and quite like you're still maintaining a vision and maintaining control.
Right. A shooting day is still a shooting
day. Yeah, exactly. And you're still talking to the actors the same way. Nothing's really different. So there was never a scale issue with Elysium. The only issue with it was the studio tampered with the ending of the film. Well, once we were in post, I'm not talking about during shooting, in a way that kind of somewhat damaged a little bit of how the theme of the film was meant to come across. And that taught me a lesson, which is regardless of how much control you think you have over it, ultimately, and this goes without saying that you're making the film for the audience, you should just keep your eye on that from a director's perspective in a way that you get what you're trying to say across and not let the studio manhandle the ending, which is what ended up happening because I didn't have final cut on it. Mm-hmm. A lot of the rest of the film is pretty much exactly how I think I wanted it to be. Meaning even if there's faults with it now that I can evaluate, at the time I was still doing what I wanted to do. So yeah, the making of that film was just a large process that was, I mean, a lot of it was very rewarding. And again, it's like you're just learning as you go through the process, you know?
Yeah, it's not so much the difference in size, although that does play into it. But you're also working with a movie star, and a movie star is more important than the writer or the director to the studio people. And I just wondered, you know, I've had different experiences with different level of actors in the movies and television that I've done. Mm-hmm. I wondered if this was a new experience that you were prepared for. And you had good luck of having somebody terrific to work with.
Yeah, I think that's what it comes down to. You know, if you think of it like a situation where your actors are there to help you realize the vision, and if you get the right people in your corner, who, you know, everyone is just part of the same team, you're in a good place. And I definitely had that with Matt and with Jody and with Shaw. You know, all of them they just wanted to facilitate what I was trying to make. So that was I don't know if it was luck so much as being aware of, I know how skew it can go on set if you're not clever about how you set up the team that you're building.
Yeah.
I felt pretty supported by all of them, and I really liked working with all of them. You know, I actually really miss Mexico City because we spent, I was in Mexico City for probably like 4 months during the making of that. It was really cool to be shooting in that location. So I would like to go back there at some point.
Well, having a great cast is so important to you. So when you get on the set every day, everybody's on the same page with you. There's an enthusiasm, and it really runs through the entire crew when there's that sense of togetherness of all joining in and making a movie together that's special, you know?
Yeah, no, totally. And, you know, I felt that way with everyone that was there. Everyone was supportive and just very cool to work with. I mean, I'm a massive fan of Jodie Foster as well. I wish I could find something. I emailed her recently actually about a film idea for something, which I think she was sort of lukewarm on, but yeah, I definitely want to find something to do with her. I just love working with her.
What's your favorite part of the process? Is it writing? Is it scouting locations? Is it working with the actors? Is it the shooting? Is it getting into the visual effects? Is it the post-production, the music? You know, there's so many elements to making a movie. And what is it that you most look forward to doing?
I think at this point, interestingly, it's changed to actually being shooting. There's something about mounting the scale of production, and I like the level of focus that it requires, where it engulfs everything to do with your life.
Yes.
You know, I really like that. I like kind of leaving set late and like having a beer with the camera crew, you know, standing looking at a sunset when gear is getting packed up. And I just like the process of shooting. And I think before I didn't enjoy it as much because maybe it just comes with experience. I don't know what it is, but I think shooting is probably my favorite phase now. Post-production is super fun too, because you get to put things together. And that can be really rewarding, but it isn't as intense. I like the intensity.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. It becomes a runaway train, a guided runaway train. Once you start production that first day, there's no stopping. You're on the downhill slide, but in a good way. And it can either get out of control or it can just speed right into it. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty fascinating when you watch things like Lust in La Mancha, you know, or Dark Souls, where it goes awry. Yeah, it's like, okay, let's not have that happen.
Yeah, Peter Medak made a great movie about the pirate movie, a documentary about the pirate movie he was making with Peter Sellers that never...
I haven't seen that.
Oh, it's brilliant. Now, why can't I remember the name of it? But look it up. It's okay. Peter Medak's most recent documentary, and it's just great about how this train wreck happened when he was making this comedic pirate movie with Peter Sellers.
Well, I know. I mean, I don't know if it has to do with Peter Sellers, but I know that he was quite difficult.
Yeah.
I love him.
But, this shows it. This shows all of those sides of him, the brilliance.
The neurosis.
And the neurosis and the madness. Yeah. So who are your heroes? Who are the people who've most inspired you? What are the movies they've made that really excited you and make you want to be in that group of filmmakers?
I think, you know, initially I would say Ridley Scott, and still Ridley Scott would probably be very, very high on that list for me. I also love the
work with as well.
Oh, you mean on Alien?
Yeah, you were able to work with him because you were part of his commercial directors group.
Right. Yeah, I remember when I met him, when I signed on to RSA, which was pretty awesome. I mean, he was definitely one of my, you know, one of my go-to filmmakers that just had a huge effect on me. But one of the things I love about Ridley is also the variety of films that he does and the types of movies, right? It's a really wide breadth of different genres and tones and subject matters.
Yeah.
So he's high on the list. James Cameron is really high on the list. I love Tarantino. I love Scorsese. I think, I'm trying to think about like when I was younger, Fincher had a huge effect on me actually when I was younger. I love Fincher's early films. I mean, I like all of his films, but films like Seven.
Yeah.
It would be in that camp. You know, I think one of my favorite films of all time is Dr. Strangelove.
Yes.
So there are certain Kubrick films as well that are, you know, massively impactful. It'd be that group.
Well, you started out making short films and commercials and doing visual effects and the like. Then you went on to big budget studio movies. Now you've just come out of the pandemic having made a very DIY movie.
Yeah.
Tell me about going back to your roots and making something small and intimate and how that came about and the actual process of producing a movie during the time of the pandemic.
Well, you know, for the longest time, I've always been very interested in what the filmmakers of Paranormal Activity and the Blair Witch Project did in terms of self-financed films that elicit a lot of terror in the audience. I thought that was a very interesting concept. And I always, in the back of my head for years, I've wanted to try to do that. So with the pandemic, it was a case of, instead of sitting around while clearly the film industry is, you know, and a lot of industries are on pause until we understand what's going on, why don't we shoot something in the same spirit, where it's self-financed and we can just put something together and go off and do it. So that's really where the idea initially came from. And I was very into the idea of trying to create a different tone to the other films that I had done, in a way that I wanted the film to feel very measured and slower and to be more of a tightening of screws and a slower burn. And so from a filmmaking challenge perspective, that was what, you know, drew me to wanting to do it, I guess, was just creating the sense of brooding tension that sort of was lying underneath the imagery and just sort of simmering. So initially it was going to be found footage like those other two films I referenced. And then it was a super weird film in the sense that it was like painting by numbers, because it was initially self-financed. So it was a case of, well, we have this location, we have access to this location, we have access to this vehicle, we have this, we have that. And almost all of the actors I had worked with before, and they all come from this kind of Oates mentality where I knew that in a lower budget environment, they would be really supportive, like we were talking about earlier, and really easy to work with and kind of, you know, help me make the film under difficult circumstances. So I knew I wanted to use Carly in the lead, and I knew I wanted to use Michael Rogers, and I just kind of put them all up on a board, and I put the locations up on the board. And then my brother and I had this real-time computer graphics idea that we wanted to do. So I knew there'd be computer graphics in it that looked like real-time footage. So I just sort of pasted it all together and came up with what the story for Demonic is. And then, you know, I think we shot it in June. So if you think March is really when everything started to shut down, June was when we shot it. And then we did the volumetric capture, I think either in August or July. And then it's incredibly humorous to me that a low budget film has 15 minutes of computer graphics in it.
Yes.
Which is, you know, kind of it's a bit counterintuitive, but it took 8 months to do that with this awesome company in the Czech Republic called UPP.
Wow.
Yeah. And then, you know, we completed it.
Well, it's interesting because the visual effects are intentionally, they go from really high end to very lo-fi.
Yeah.
And it must have been a lot of fun for you to mess around with that.
And yeah, I mean, the process that we were using is actually relatively cutting edge. It's called volumetric capture as opposed to motion capture. And because of where it's at, because it's so early, there's inherently a ton of errors and glitches, and the resolution just isn't really where it should be.
But you kind of embraced that.
Yeah, I knew that if we were to write that into the script in a way where it felt like a prototype piece of technology, that the audience would go along with it. And that's really how we approached it. You know, it was like, let's just embrace all of the glitches and the errors.
But your films almost always embrace technology or reject technology.
Right.
But in this case, this is probably your most blatantly horrific film. It's truly a horror film. And with the title Demonic, it should be.
Yeah.
Tell me about that experience and about being your own boss. You have nobody to answer to but yourself when you're self-financed.
Well, actually, the film that I was going to do before the pandemic was financed by a company called AGC with Stuart Ford. And when the pandemic hit and everything was put on pause, I told them I was going to go do this. So they were interested in matching the amount that we had put in. Huh? And so we effectively doubled our budget. So that's why I said it was initially self-financed, and then its budget, you know, increased by, it doubled. And so at that point, you're just partners with AGC, and they would give me thoughts on, you know, if the edit was moving in a direction that was, you know, too slow, or so we would bounce thoughts back and forth like that. So it still did feel very creative though.
Well, often a lower budget doesn't give you the ability to use things that cost a lot as a crutch. You're relying on your ingenuity. So tell me how production differed for you in this regard when you don't have a studio behind you and you have your imagination and a limited pocketbook.
You know, I think everything really came down to this idea of just trying to create a sense of unease the whole time. And I think regardless of what your budget level is, you can definitely pull that off in a low budget environment. So hopefully the audience feels the sense of like dread that's just sort of bubbling there the whole time. The place we tried obviously as hard as we could to make the production level look as high as quality, as high quality as possible. But the danger with that is that maybe the audience is expecting more in the third act that you just can't deliver because it's not set up that way. But I thought, let's just, instead of purposefully making it look cheap, let's just make it look as good as we can make it look for the money that we have. Which you know, actually is a really awesome way to sharpen your own skills when you, like this film that I may go on to now is a $60 million budget film. And it's like, you can use a lot of the hone sharpening that you've just done on something super low budget to kind of get more out of that. And I love the idea of oscillating between two different budget levels like that. And sort of, yeah. it keeps you agile, you know?
Yeah, it keeps you sharp. Yeah. What have you not done as a filmmaker that you're dying to still do?
I definitely comedy, I think.
You know? Yeah?
Yeah, but fucked up, weird comedy. It's probably only funny to me.
Anything you could relate that to?
I mean, if you watch God on Oats or you watch Cooking with Bill, like in that direction, a sort of, you know, yeah, I mean, God would be good. So I think it's a mixture of dark, pessimistic philosophy mixed with ridiculous slapstick. You know, a layer of ridiculousness, Monty Python over the top of it. I'd like to do a war film, dead serious war film. I would love to do. I love the genre of war film.
Yeah. What have you seen lately that has stimulated you?
I think probably in the last few years, the best film I've seen in the genre of war would be Fury, I would say.
Mm.
Yeah, okay. I really liked Fury. Black Hawk Down is one of my favorite films ever.
Again, yeah.
Yeah, so that would be another genre. I mean, I love horror. I would love to. I know that this film isn't explicitly horror because it has thriller and science fiction elements. But, I mean, even fantasy. You know, all of the above.
Great. Well, yeah. Neil, thank you so much for joining us here and talking about your work. I can't wait to see what's next and to see what the audience reaction is to Demonic.
Yeah, thank you.
It's exciting.
Thanks for having me on.
It's always a pleasure and great to meet you. Thanks, Neil.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris on the Dread Podcast Network. Download new episodes every Wednesday and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app.